This morning, in the second hour of the program, we'll be talking with journalist Barbara Ehrenreich. She's written a lot about economic dislocation in America. And a couple of years ago, in 1998, she set out to answer this question. How is it that people manage to make ends meet on the kind of wages that are available to unskilled workers? And rather than going out and interviewing people who were trying to do this, she decided to try and do it for herself. And she spent time in three different places, in Florida, where she lived, in Maine, and in Minnesota, working as a waitress, a hotel maid, a sales clerk at a Walmart, seeing, in fact, if she could manage to live on the wages that these jobs paid. And the bottom line answer to the question is, well, no, not really. Not if you want to, not unless you want to be sleeping in your car. And she's written about this, an account of her experiences, in a recently published book, which is titled Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America. It's published by Metropolitan Books, and she's joining us this morning by telephone to talk about the book and her experiences. And your questions certainly are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. So at any point, you can give us a call, join the conversation. We just ask people to try and be brief so we can keep things moving along, but anyone's welcome to call. Our guest is the author of a number of books, including Blood Rights, The Worst Years of Our Lives, Fear of Falling, a book that was nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award, and eight others. She's also a frequent contributor to publications including Time, Harper's, The New Republic, The Nation, The New York Times Magazine. And as I said, she's joining us this morning by telephone. Ms. Ehrenreich, hello.
Hi, good to be with you, David.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. Here, you did something in doing this book that I think probably not very many journalists do anymore, if they ever did. That is, I guess that's what we call participant observation. That is, rather than watching somebody do something or talk with somebody about their experiences, you decided you would go out and try it yourself. What led you to actually decide to try and live this way yourself?
Well, there is a tradition of journalism doing this. The early 20th century had a lot of examples of journalists going out working in factories, you know, doing whatever and then writing about it. That, however, was not my idea here. I had just been talking to a magazine editor, the editor of Harper's, about, you know, what's the math of it. So many welfare reform I'd clicked in. I was talking to him in 1998. We were saying, you know, how is it possible that people are going to be, women are going to be able to leave welfare and support their families on the wages available out there to entry-level workers. I was saying, you know, the math doesn't look too good, but everybody seems to believe it's possible. And then I said, this may have been a big mistake, I said, you know, somebody should go out there and do the old-fashioned kind of journalism, try it for themselves, and write about that. Hmm. Anyway, he said, you. And there I was, stuck with the assignment from hell, I thought, at first. As a freelancer, you don't say no.
Mm. Well, and certainly reading about your experiences, I think one would not want to minimize just how difficult an assignment this was for a variety of reasons, maybe chief among them just how the fact that you were going out there, you were getting real jobs, you were doing the work, and that it was physically demanding, let alone the whole question of how it is that you tried to indeed live on what it was they were going to pay you.
Yeah, I mean, there were really two problems. One was doing the work, and I was challenged by all of these jobs. You left out a couple of them. I was also a maid with a house cleaning service and a nursing home aide, but every job required learning a lot of stuff and learning it very quickly. I found I really, even though I, you know, I'm a journalist, I have a PhD, I thought this was not easy. And physically, also, very exhausting. All of these were jobs that you're on your feet, bending, lifting, carrying, etc., for hours on end. So that was hard, but even harder, I think, was, you know, was the making ends meet part. I give myself sort of a B or a B plus for doing the jobs pretty well, and I'm kind of proud. I screwed up sometimes, and that's all those embarrassing stories are in the book, but I both basically did pretty well. But I didn't do so well at, figuring out how to survive on this kind of money. I averaged $7 an hour, and I should emphasize that's well above the national minimum wage. In fact, as a single, it's just one person doing this, I was even above the poverty level. So, it was quite dismaying that it was so hard to make ends meet.
Yeah, and you had an advantage over a lot of other people. That is, the only person you had to take care of was yourself.
Mm-hmm. I also had a car. I was at a rent-a-rec, and I didn't count the rental price, the rental fees. I didn't deduct that from my wages. I just said, I'm going to be a low-income person with a car here. Otherwise, it would be a long, long story about waiting for buses. So I had these advantages. I'm also white. I'm English-speaking. And I think that does make a difference in what kind of jobs you get offered, possibly a real advantage in some of these cases. Mm-hmm. But the part I was really not prepared for was the cost of housing. I sort of assumed that in every case I would get, a little efficiency apartment. It would be minimal but pleasant enough, and it would cost about $500 a month. That was my assumption as I started out. And I did start out with such a place, but it was at such a distance from where the jobs were that I finally decided it was too expensive. The gas part was too expensive. Then I was plunged into there's a really discouraging housing market. In Maine and in Minnesota, I couldn't find any apartment. I mean, there were just none renting for less than, say, $800 a month. Zero. Mm-hmm. So I did what a lot of low-income people do, and that is stayed in residential motels, paying by the week, and those are really expensive. Mm.
And what does that cost? Would that cost you?
One of them, fortunately, was about $120 a week. Still, that's quite a bit of money on a monthly basis for one tiny room with a kitchenette. In that case, but I felt that was a pretty good deal. Then in the Twin Cities area, the only place I could find was a residential motel at $250 a week, which was, of course, impossible. And also, that place had no kitchenette, no microwave, no fridge. So another expense was that I had to then get all my food at convenience stores and fast food restaurants, which is expensive as well as not very yummy.
Yeah, and not very healthy on top of it.
Well, that was the least of my concerns.
Let's talk a little bit more about the experience. You started out in your hometown and started out working as a waitress.
Mm-hmm. And that's the first job I got.
And it wasn't very long before you discovered that wasn't going to cut it, and so you actually had to get a second job. So you were working two waitressing jobs. You're working at one place and then going to another place and doing the same thing.
Yeah, not possible. I realized that a lot of the other people I was working with had two jobs, so I said, okay, that's what I have to do. But I think the trick is you can't have two. It's hard to have two jobs that are where you're on your feet and running all the time. And I just felt, I was going into a state of meltdown by the end of the second shift in one day. Plus, there's a problem, and this may seem like a trivial problem, but it's the kind of thing that looms very large, that you have a uniform for every job, maybe just a polo shirt and slacks, but it has to be, they usually only give you one, and you have to somehow manage to launder that in between these shifts. And I thought, when do I do that? I hate to think what you do if you're a parent, like a single parent in these situations, because there would be no time, just no time to be with your children.
How much were you making on these jobs?
I averaged $7 an hour. The lowest paid was about $6.60 an hour in the house cleaning job, and I did get up to $7.50 an hour occasionally, and even more as a waitress.
Did you feel that, I suppose one imagines that if this is your life and you live with these circumstances, that you learned tricks, you learned things that the rest of us wouldn't know because we don't have to know that. Did you find that the people that you're working with had particular survival skills that you realized that you didn't have and that you would need if this was going to work?
No, alas. I discovered that in some ways it's more expensive to be poor. For the reasons like I was just saying, if you don't have that first month's rent and security deposit and so on to get into a real monthly rental apartment, you'll be really ripped off in these residential motels. If you don't have a place to cook, you'll be paying too much for food. So I thought, not only you paid little, but some of the expenses are just wild here. So no, I didn't see that people had any great tricks. In fact, what I saw was people giving up, going without certain things like health insurance, which was, I should say, was very often offered by the employer, but the employee contribution would be so high that most people I talked to didn't bother with it. If you're getting, say, $1,400 a month, you can't afford a couple of hundred dollars out of that for health insurance. So that's what I saw, people going without things that they really needed and they needed to have.
It seems like, as you suggested, maybe the big problem was if you have this kind of income, finding decent housing. And it sounds as if the people that you came to know that were also working in these places, the way that they dealt with that was one way or another, they were living with somebody else and sharing those expenses. They were living with a boyfriend, they were living with somebody else, that was the way, one of the things that they could do to try to get by.
Yeah, although not everybody has a boyfriend or a spouse or a grown child to pitch in with the rent, and I did work alongside some people who turned out to be homeless, who were sleeping in their van in one case, a pickup truck in another case. And I thought it was very odd and interesting that they didn't describe themselves as homeless because they had that vehicle to sleep in. That was considered a step above, sleeping in the streets, of course. In one place I worked, the manager very kindly let one of my fellow workers park her pickup truck in the parking lot that went with this restaurant, which she considered a great benefit because better to be in a parking lot that had an occasional security guard patrolling it at night than to be just on the street. And that seemed so sad to me that when an American worker regards that as a benefit, things have really gone pretty far downhill.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the things that's striking about these folks in this situation is just how I'm sure you start to feel stuck because it's difficult to find other work. This may be the best work that you can find. You can't afford to lose that job. So you end up putting up with a lot of stuff that maybe a lot of the rest of us just wouldn't put up with because we know we don't have to, but they do.
Yeah, I think what they put up with in the low-wage workplace is a lot of, I would say mistreatment or bad treatment on the part of management, all the way from just lack of appreciation to things that look to me fairly abusive, like a kind of harassment. That was for me the hardest thing to adjust to, as a grown woman of, who's had a career in journalism and everything, and it has a certain amount of self-esteem, I should think, to suddenly be put in these situations where sometimes, other people certainly were, yelled at, with somebody yelling a couple of inches from your nose, punished for, by being made to do really unpleasant tasks for some infraction or imagined infraction, and having to submit to all kinds of rules, the reasoning for which I cannot imagine, like rules such as no chatting with your fellow workers, you know, that you could be disciplined if you were caught talking about anything that was not immediately related to the work at hand. So, of course, you have to kind of sneak to have a normal human interaction. You know, so that sort of thing, I think, wears people down.
Mm-hmm. And that was just because the management thought that anything that was not directly related to the job was that you were wasting their time, and they said, well, we're not paying you to stand around and socialize with your coworkers. We're paying you to get those plates out of the kitchen and out there into the dining room so that then we can get those people fed. They can get out of here so we can get somebody else in that table.
Well, nobody ever chatted when there were things that were urgent things to be done. It's when you were maybe working next to somebody and, you know, doing something that didn't require, you know, that you could, where you could have a chat while you were doing it, or there was a little bit of downtime. Like at Walmart, there was our manager for our department said there was to be no talking, and that was how he put it, no talking. And so we would kind of sneak behind, you know, a stack of clothing or racks or shelves, you know, to exchange a few words, very often about things that were going on at work. I don't know what goes through management's mind, but I think maybe they worry that if people could freely talk, if you had the right to free speech that we supposedly have in the rest of our lives, that we might do more to exchange grievances.
Oh, they'd be conspiring.
Yeah.
Our guest this morning, I should introduce again, our guest this morning is journalist Barbara Ehrenreich, and we are talking about her newest book, which is titled Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America, published by Metropolitan Books, which is the result of her experiences, and this was back in 1998, as we explained, in three...
Well, 1998 to 2000.
Oh, pardon me. Over a period...
A year ago that I completed this research.
So starting, I guess we should say, starting in 1998,
mm-hmm.
Where she went out and got the best and unskilled, and we'll want to put that in quotes. I think that's one of the things you come away with this is that it leads you to think differently about that term and how we apply it to people. But she went out there and got the best jobs that she could. And as you mentioned, she worked as a waitress. She worked in a nursing home. She worked in a Walmart and has written about the experiences in the book. And needless to say, when you went to these places, you didn't tell anybody who you were. And the fact that you were what you were doing was collecting experience that would end up being an article and then a book.
Well, I wasn't really, though, undercover in the classic sense. I had to use my own name and Social Security number, obviously, you know, when you apply for jobs. And toward the end of every, you know, every job or when I was about to leave the city, I would tell some of the people I'd gotten closer to what I was really doing and why I'd been working there, and that I was going to write about this.
Mm. Well, it was interesting, though, that you note that in many cases their reaction was, well, does that mean you're not coming in tomorrow?
Yeah, I mean, I thought people would be, like, amazed and impressed. But, you know, they were kind of underwhelmed. I think that's because a lot of people in all kinds of jobs consider themselves to be writers, too, and are writing, you know, writing poems or journals or even a book. In the case of one woman, I got to know, you know, I don't know if that'll ever be published, but it's not so odd to be a writer. And I'd sort of have to shake people and say, no, I'm writing about this, you know, this, it's sort of an expose. And then they'd,
Mm-hmm. Well, then I wonder, I would expect that they might still feel that that'd be swell for you, but that as far as they were concerned in their lives, where it went, it wouldn't mean that there was going to be any big difference in their lives or in what they do. Ms. Ehrenreich? I think we've lost the guest. Maybe we'll put her on hold and we'll see if we can get set up with her again. In the meantime, actually, we're almost at the midpoint, so that would be giving me a good opportunity to introduce again. We're speaking with journalist Barbara Ehrenreich. She's the author of a number of books. including Fear of Falling, one that we talked about here on the show and which was nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award, and 8 or 9 others. She's a frequent contributor to a number of publications, among them Time and Harper's Magazine, The New Republic, The Nation, The New York Times Magazine. She makes her home in Florida, in Key West, and she has written a book based on her experiences over a couple of years working in minimum wage jobs. She explains that she set out to answer this question: would it really be possible? How do people manage to live on the wages that are available to unskilled workers? And so she spent time in Florida, where she lived, and also Maine and in Minnesota, working in various jobs. We've talked a little bit about the waitressing job. She also worked in a Walmart. She worked as a house cleaner and has written all about this in her new book here, Nickel and Dimed, on Not Getting By in America. And questions are welcome. In fact, we got somebody here who we'll get right to in just a second. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Ms. Ehrenreich?
Yes.
I'm sorry, we lost you for a moment there.
Yeah, not my fault.
Okay, well, hopefully not on our end. One doesn't know. At any rate, we have a caller here to talk with, so why don't we do that? And they're in Champaign on line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'm really glad you've done this because I think this is, wow, just against American tradition, and I'm really glad that you are. A couple things I think about is here in Champaign-Urbana, we have a very high quality of life, but we also have very high rent, federally speaking, and this is a very neutral administrative organization that does this. Median rent to start here is $600 in Champaign-Urbana, and certainly most jobs here pay what you were making or less when you talk about entry level, and I find that very frightening. And I think of something that occurred a lot in the 80s when I particularly was entering the job market, and that was that large employers, noticeable name brand people, would not hire full-time staff. I'm really surprised, in fact, that you were able to find full-time employment, and I'd like to hear your comments on that, and I agree with you of the privileges of being middle class has quite a few benefits other than the ones people normally think of. So if you could comment on that, how did you find full-time work and not get stuck working 3 split shifts? So thanks a lot.
Okay. Well, there was no trouble finding full-time work, actually. The years in which I was doing this, 98 to 2000, very tight labor market, which still is a very tight labor market. Everywhere there were help wanted, hiring now, hiring signs. So there really wasn't any problem finding a job. Employers were, like, begging you to work for them. The one thing they didn't seem to want to do is raise the wages enough to make that really worthwhile.
On one of the, I think, as I remember, when you decided that, when you were in Florida, you decided you had to have the second job, you went and were trained there, and that people weren't particularly nice, and that you discovered that one of the reasons is that apparently the job seems to be so grim that a lot of people, after one day, they just never come back. So
yeah,
it sounds as if there's a lot of turnover in these
turnover.
Jobs.
It's wild in the these jobs. Like at Walmart, for example, as far as I could tell, they were recruiting something like 10 or 12 new people every single day. I don't know how, probably 300 or so were employed in the whole store. I can only guess. But that's a lot of turnover. I think that management just accepts that. That rather than, as one of my Walmart coworkers put it to me, they'd rather just get somebody new in than really, value the people they have. That's how she put it,
Well, that's what one would imagine, that kind of mindset would, you'd find that kind of mindset in an employer if that person thought, well, it doesn't really matter how I treat this person because I can very easily get somebody else, and that there's always going to be a line of people that are be willing to have that job, and so, one person works for a few months and they leave, I can always get somebody else.
Yeah, although I read an interesting article recently in the Wall Street Journal. It said that some of the fast food places, for example, are beginning to realize how much money they lose through that kind of policy. Because every time you take in somebody new, there is some training. There's some time that it's not as efficient as having people who are good employees who really know their work and are willing to stay. So it said some of the fast food places are beginning to revise their policy and not see labor as such a renewable resource.
And in the various places that you worked, were the people that were in the management roles, the people who were your supervisors, were they doing very much, if we talk in terms of their standard of living, how much money they were making, were they doing very much better than you were?
No, I don't think a whole lot better. One of them told me he was making $400 a month, and with very long hours, because management doesn't punch in and punch out for a regular shift. They might have to work longer. So that's about $20,000 a year compared to the, $12,000 or $14,000 a year that his particular underlings were making.
Mm. We have some other callers. Let's talk with someone here in Chicago on our line 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Your time mainly was spent in the profit-making sector. I've got some experience in, as a governmental worker. This goes back 15 years working for the state of Illinois, and a good percentage of the people there, in the lower grades, of course, were on welfare because the salaries were so low. They were getting food stamps and that sort of thing. Otherwise, they couldn't make it working full-time for the state and for the great state of Illinois. And I'm sure this is not just limited to Illinois.
Well, that's a pretty sad commentary on the state of Illinois. But, one thing has changed in the last 15 years. It's a lot harder to get things like food stamps. Big cutbacks in food stamps. Through state policies that went along with welfare reform in 1996 when that was introduced. So it's harder to get some of those sorts of help today.
Yeah, it's, I'll leave it at that. There's too much to discuss, and I'll leave it to someone else to call.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, we'll continue. We'll come back here locally to an Urbana person here, line number 1. Hello.
Hi. Yes, I was wondering just about if you had observed any sort of signs of resistance among among the people you were talking to, whether on a sort of personal levels or within the company, or I don't know whether any of these jobs were unionized at all or anything like that. I was just wondering if you'd care to comment on
that. None of the jobs were unionized, no.
Mm-hmm.
I never came anywhere near close to a union job.
Mm-hmm.
Signs of resistance, people have to break rules in small ways just to survive. Like if you're in a job that doesn't offer bathroom breaks, although legally now they're supposed to, according to OSHA, then you've got to break a rule just for your physical survival now and then. I saw a variety of attitudes. I mean, a lot of discontent and a lot of resentment, combined, though, with people taking a lot of pride in their jobs. I never saw anybody who slacked off and didn't appear to care about doing well. Everybody did. Sometimes the resentment was that management would sometimes appear to be getting in the way of our doing a good job. That management priorities were so geared to the money, and our priority might be, like at Walmart, having our department really look good. And management might just want to have all the possible inventory stuck out on the floor, no matter how messy and unappealing it was. So, yeah, a lot of that kind of feeling.
Mm-hmm. Any sort of larger organization of that, or do you think it was mostly isolated and sort of individual acts?
No, I didn't see this in any organized form.
Right.
No, and, it's very hard to get organized into a union, I think, and I appreciate that much more having done this, because now I see how easily you can be fired.
Right.
For just the most trivial reason. I've learned that the AFL-CIO estimates that about 10,000 American workers are fired every year for union activity.
Right.
Now, that is illegal. You can't be fired for union activity. So they're more commonly fired on, you know, some other excuse. Like at Walmart, there's a rule that you can't say damn or hell or anything of that nature. And people, I have read this, I didn't experience it firsthand, who were involved in union activity have been fired and then given the explanation it was because they used one of those taboo words.
Right. I mean, listeners in this area might be interested to know there's been a Walmart going up in Savoy here, which I know a lot of local unions have been, even the building of the actual facility hasn't been unionized, and I imagine the people who work there will have similar issues. So thank you very much.
Okay. We'll go on again to another Urbana person. This is line two. Hello.
Yeah, a couple comments, a couple questions. Comment one is that I'm sure you're right about that conspiracy theory of the way they manage their employees, but I think they also think it's like an early warning system for just the general level of compliance, because what they're really worried about is that the employees won't steal, and they figure if the little rules are broken, you know, maybe the next thing on the list will be that they'll be taking home the inventory. And then another comment is that and this would lead directly to the first question, is that I would think this is exactly the kind of thing that those people who are more or less in the privileged classes don't want to hear about. You know, you it's true on so many levels that there's a deliberate a system in place to stop the negative feedback from coming, from disturbing certain people. And like in particular, I remember reading about the huge problems in Aspen, Colorado, with housing, because, you know, all the waiters and everyone else and low-paying jobs, you know, had no place to live. And I was just curious because I have no idea if it's true, but I imagine you hobnob with a lot of people who might think that, the way to go is totally laissez-faire and, the market is God. Has anyone offered any kind of opinion or view that the market could alleviate the kind of housing problems that you saw?
Well, the housing problems are, that's so clearly a result of the market working very well. You know, that people with money come in and have taken over the stock, housing stock that once was available to working people. And that's just gone over. I mean, it's not there, anymore. Affordable housing just seems to be almost, non-existent in many urban areas. So that's because the market works so well. Where the market doesn't seem to work very well, in my opinion, is in bringing up wages. Because if there is what employers have called a labor shortage for the last few years, why don't they raise wages? Well, because they don't want to. You know, they will do anything to resist that, anything to prevent unions from coming in. And another quirky little management thing was, they'll offer strange little benefits, little perks, like at Walmart. Once a week, if you could arrange your break on the right time, you could have a free donut given out by management. And you're supposed to then be happy with your $7 an hour with a great perk like that. So, yeah, I mean, the market, it works in some ways, and sometimes it doesn't work, but it doesn't work too. It certainly has been working to working people's or low-income people's advantage in terms of housing. As for the theft problem, I don't know what to say. I never saw anybody steal anything or talk about stealing anything. But I certainly did find it very unpleasant to be regarded all the time as a potential thief. And I don't think my coworkers like that either.
Well, I remember when I was taking some MBA courses, they say that the 80% of theft from retail stores is by the employees. But let me ask you this other question, then I'll hang up. I was just listening to what you said about the using your own name and Social Security number, and I was thinking about all the trouble ABC had with reporting, getting reporters, hidden cameras and stuff like that. Are you saying that Walmart knew your work history and they still employed you? And I guess
no, they didn't know my work history, but there was nothing to stop them from finding it out. On application forms, I said I was a divorced homemaker reentering the workforce, which is true. As far as it goes, I didn't, you know, mention the freelance part of my life, which is how I've supported myself for years. But this is a little bit different case than the ABC, and it was a Food Lion supermarket. So ABC sent in reporters with hidden cameras to record the way they handled meat. And, you know, it was very much exposing things that would make a turn off a consumer a lot. And I was not there, you know, I was not in these jobs to say anything bad about the business in terms of how customers would view them.
Okay. We have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, talking with Barbara Ehrenreich about her most recent book titled Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America. It's published by Metropolitan Books, and it is indeed about her experience over spread over a couple of years, spending time working in essentially a minimum wage jobs, the kind of jobs that an unskilled person could get in Maine, in Minneapolis, and in Key West, where she lives. And she's written about her experiences and the challenges of trying to make do and live on what those jobs would pay. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL, the numbers to call if you'd like to join the conversation. Here's another person in Urbana. It's line 3.
Hi. I have a comment on the financial aspect. I think I heard you say that you made around $1,400 a month and that you couldn't make ends meet with that much money. Well, I'm an international student here, and I guess I make like $1,300, and I live alone. I pay $400 rent. Even then, I managed to put $2,000 in my IRA and also send some money back home. So I think one of the issues is financial management, where you learn how to spend the money you get rather than try to live beyond your means. Do you think this is one of the problems encountered by the people who live on this minimum wage stuff?
Well, no. Actually, I should have said $14,000 a year was about what I was making, $1,200 a month.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You see, I thought it would be pretty manageable, too, but that's because I was assuming at the outset that I would be able to pay rents of about $500 a month.
Uh-huh.
And as I said, that was just the deal breaker. When I couldn't, you know, find places that cost that much, it was very, very hard.
Okay.
So that may not be true in Champaign-Urbana. There may be that there is more affordable housing. So that was the toughest part.
Yeah, because, like, I know a lot of graduate students everywhere all around the country who make around the same amount of money that I do, yet they manage to live very well. They don't have any debts, and, you know, so I was just thinking.
Yeah, well, I've been a graduate student myself, and that gave me a certain amount of feeling of cockiness when I start out on this, because I said, hey, you know, I've lived on very, very little, not only when I was a graduate student, but when my children were small.
Uh-huh.
And I was starting out as a writer. I said, hey, I know how to do this. I had in my mind I was going to make these big lentil stews and freeze them up in Tupperware, and then I'd, you know, I can eat very cheaply. I know how to do it.
Okay.
But,
thank you for
surprise, you know, I was living in a place that I didn't have a pot, I didn't have Tupperware, I didn't have, you know, I didn't have all this sort of basic stuff that I just assume because I have it in my own kitchen. And when I figured out what it would cost to buy all that stuff, it would have been an investment of $25. Now, so that one-time investment sort of held me back.
Hmm.
You know, there were a lot of things like that that had not occurred to me at the beginning were going to be obstacles, at least in the short term.
We have several other callers here. Again, I appreciate the comments of the last person, and we'll just keep going. Next, it will be Champagne Line 1. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to ask our guest about the psychological side of this, and I'm wondering because I've lived very Spartanly myself in the past. When about 10 years ago, I was living as a starving, unhappy, unproductive writer on about $225 a month, and I did make ends meet. Now, I had also dropped out of college at that point. And for me, it wasn't so much tough, you know, making ends meet. I mean, I found ways to do things like, you know, getting a used oil can from a garbage can in a gas station to oil my bike chain so I wouldn't have to pay for oil. You know, you just learn how to do things like that. But what I found was the hardest, and I don't know if our guest has some feeling for this, is feeling like the fear that this was going to be as high as you were going to go. This was going to be it, you know, and there was just no respect for it. It's like if you're a freelance writer and you've published in some well-known, you know, some well-known papers or magazines, you know, that's instant respect. And I'm wondering if in the back of your mind you always knew you had this career, and so you never felt like a Walmart employee was all you were, or you were just completely interchangeable with a million other people. I'm just wondering if what you know or think about the psychological side. I hope I've made myself clear. Do you understand the question?
Yeah. Well, I knew, and I say it right in the beginning of the book. I knew I was not going to be, quote, experiencing poverty because I wouldn't have that psychological effect you're talking about. I would always know I was getting out of it. In the back of my mind, I know I was going back to my own real home and career and, you know, good food to eat and so on. So I was not going to, you know, experience that. But, you know, I did learn from my coworkers in some cases. You know, they would say things like, nobody respects us. Nobody cares about us. Little comments like that. And I could only think, oh, God, how sad, you know, for years and years to feel that or be in a job that a lot of people either look down on or just don't even see.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I guess that's a whole other book. Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. So we'll see if we can quick get one more person at least. This is Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, my question is related to did you encounter many Hispanic workers? I'm talking the ones who barely speak English in your job. What was their attitude towards the conditions they were working under, and how the other workers saw them? That's the question.
Well, I can't say single out anything particularly different about Hispanic or Latina workers. I worked in some places with quite a multinational bunch of people. Interestingly enough, some of the immigrant workers in Florida now are from Eastern Europe and don't speak good English. You know, they're from Poland or the Czech Republic or somewhere. And then you have Haitians, people from other parts of the Caribbean, quite a mixture. There was quite a mixture in the Walmart in Minnesota. And, you know, I think that if there was a big language barrier, I couldn't easily communicate with them, right? It was hard to communicate, though I did try pretty hard in some cases. But, no, I didn't see that there was anything distinctive about any particular ethnic group, at least not in the time that I was there to find it out.
Just one more question: did you see an increment on Latino workers?
Any what?
An increment.
What meaning? I don't understand.
More Latino workers working where were you working?
I wasn't anywhere long enough to see if there was a change.
Okay.
I can't say that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Well, we're almost to the part where we're going to have to stop, and I'm sorry we have a couple of people we can't take. Now that you've made it through all this experience, been thinking about it, you've written about it, what do you take away, particularly if one asks the question, well, if we could do something on a policy level that would benefit people like those that you worked with, what would it be?
Oh, so many things. Dave, you're now right at the end, you asked this question.
I know. I probably should have asked at the beginning, right?
So many, you know, it just so many things that are like an obvious, like why don't we have national health insurance like other civilized nations? You know, that's a big question. Why don't we do something about the housing crisis? Because as the affordable housing stock has shrunk, the government responsibility toward helping people, low-income people with housing, has also shrunk. Why don't we have subsidized child care to help working parents, especially the single parents? Oh, I could go on and on.
Would an increase in the minimum wage, particularly the kind that would be politically possible, make very much difference?
I think so. I mean, even a little increase, because the minimum wage is so far behind. It just hasn't gone up in, over 10 years, I think. That would boost things for quite people, a lot of people who are near the minimum wage, too. But I think also, you know, in the long term, only in the interest of democracy, it has to become possible for people to organize into unions or whatever kind of associations they want to. And right now, management very often runs the workplace as a dictatorship where that's impossible.
Well, we are going to have to leave it there because we're here at the end of the time. And we want to say, Ms. Ehrenreich, thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Our guest, Barbara Ehrenreich. And once again, if you would like to read the book we've been talking about, it's titled Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America. It's out now. It's published by Metropolitan Books.